Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media, the old GM Boxwood Road plant is about to be demolished, officially closing the book on its long history as an auto assembly plant and beginning what many hope will be a new chapter in its role as an economic engine for the first state economy. Contributor John Hurdle joins us to offer a look ahead at what's next at the Boxwood Road site. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also begin our series of candidate conversations in the state treasurer's race, hearing from Democrat Colleen Davis and Republican Ken Simpler. Plus, our arts playlist has more on a concert coming to the Delaware Art Museum. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the latest news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The former GM Boxwood Road auto plant will soon be nothing but a memory. Demolition of the plant is set to begin soon, almost a decade after it was shuttered, and a subsequent attempt by Fisker to revive it and make luxury electric cars there failed. The good news is that demolition marks the next step in an effort to give the site, long an important player in Delaware's economy, a new life. Contributor John Hurdle recently took a look at what that new life may look like, and his piece is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. He joined me earlier this week to delve into what he found. The plant's new life is as a logistics center. Can you give people kind of a quick thumbnail sketch of exactly what a logistics center is?
Well, it's a place where companies use to distribute goods that have been bought online. E-commerce is a rapidly growing sector, and if you order any kind of items from companies like Amazon or FedEx or UPS, then those goods will come from a center. They'll be the goods will be delivered to a place such as that that's about to take place on Boxwood Road, and will be distributed to the customers from there. And the essential reason for this, for the big growth in demand for these places, is that there's increasing demand for same day delivery.
So, in a lot of ways, it's just a hub for all these kind of delivery services.
Yes, that's right.
Do we have a sense what the logistics center at Boxwood Road would look like?
Yes, the developer, which is Newport-based Harvey Hanna Associates, says there's going to be four buildings. They're going to be dividable. They're going to cover approximately the same area that the existing auto plant covers, which is 3 million square feet. And the buildings are going to be built to the specifications that are required by logistics companies. That is, they're going to have high ceilings of about 40 feet. And then there'll be a lot of access for inbound and outbound trucks.
So why does this site set up so well for this type of logistics center?
Well, I think the answer, Tom, is simply the old real estate adage of location, location, location. What the developer says is the site is around about 2 miles from I-95. It has rail links with the Port of Wilmington, which, of course, is in the process of it's about to be upgraded with a multi-million dollar investment for more containers. And the essential point is that it's Boxwood Road is at the heart of the very populous northeast market. And so, what the developer says is that it's within an 8-hour drive of around 50 million people. And that will be very appealing to logistics companies that want to be able to deliver items to their customers on the same day that they're ordered.
So after the GM plant closed, and for much of the time since, efforts at Boxwood Road are really focused on bringing another auto manufacturer in. We know Fisker's plan to take over failed when it went bankrupt, but why not keep pursuing that path, finding a new auto manufacturer, or at the very least maybe trying to repurpose some of those auto manufacturing buildings to another purpose rather than just completely demolishing the site?
Well, what they found, Tom, is that the building turned out to be completely unsuitable for modern manufacturers, and particularly any auto industry manufacturers. The developer's original plan was to repurpose the site for the manufacturing industry, and they spent about a year marketing the plant to manufacturers, and after that point, and concluded that there simply wasn't enough interest. And one of the reasons for that is that most of the equipment within the factory that might have been reused by modern manufacturers, most of that equipment had been removed, and then what remained was obsolete. So then they focused their efforts on the logistics industry, but it turned out that the plant was actually obsolete for that industry as well. And the reason for that is that the ceiling heights were too low, that the grid pattern inside the plant with the columns were too close together. And so they decided really the only future for it was to demolish it, completely raise it to the slab and start again.
So what's the timeline for this project? How long until we start seeing the new Boxwood Road?
Well, the demolition is due to begin within the next month. The developer says that they are hoping to break ground on the first of the four new buildings at some point in the spring of 2019. Their plan is to complete the entire project within 9 years.
Are there any expectations at this juncture for what this all will mean to the economy in Delaware in terms of jobs, taxes, and those type of things?
Well, indeed. The developer had an economic study done by the eConsult group. And what that found was that the project would generate about 2,100 permanent jobs in fields like logistics and technology and engineering. They estimated that there'd be a combined economic impact of about $280 million a year, and that it would also generate about $7.5 million a year in state and local taxes. During construction, they're saying the project's going to generate about 160 jobs and about $6.8 million a year in taxes.
And while that's good news looking forward, this is truly kind of the end of an era, isn't it? There's a lot of history on this site that's now just going to go away.
Well, yes, and that became clear to me when I had a conversation with a gentleman called Stan Kaminsky, and he is a former assembly line worker who worked in the plant for 32 years until he retired in 2003, and he told me that it's very hard for him to see the removal of this building where, he had several decades of what he said was very happy employment. He was well paid. He got good benefits. And very importantly, he made a lot of lifelong friends. He witnessed the final car coming off the assembly line. And he's actually chronicled the whole process. He's in the process of writing a book. And he's actually received permission to photograph the demolition, and now he said that he finds this all quite an emotional experience because it's obviously been an important part of his life, but he recognizes in the end that it's better to reuse the site and provide employment and economic gain for the local area than to see this plant just sitting empty as it has been for the last 9 years.
Our thanks to contributor John Hurdle for his time on The Green this week. Again, you can find his piece on what's next for the old GM Boxwood Road plant online right now at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. We begin our candidate conversations in the race for state treasurer next. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. We continue our series of candidate conversations, part of Delaware Public Media's 2018 election coverage, and the Delaware debates we're producing again this fall with the University of Delaware's Center for Political Communication. We've reached out to all candidates running in statewide races and invited them to sit down with us for an interview. Candidates in each race are asked the same set of questions to allow you to get to know them and compare them. In addition to airing them here on The Green, the interviews will also be available at DelawarePublic.org and DelawareDebates.org right through Election Day in November. This week, we turn to the race for state treasurer. Incumbent Republican Ken Simpler is being challenged by Democrat Colleen Davis and the Green Party's David Chandler. We start with Colleen Davis. She's making her first bid for public office after working as a financial consultant for medical systems in and around the state of Delaware. Here is our candidate conversation with Democrat Colleen Davis. So we start each of these interviews off with the most basic question. Why are you running for state treasurer?
Yeah. Well, thank you. Again, I appreciate you having me here. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Sussex County after fraudulent activity resulted in the loss of my family home and all of our possessions as a child. And we moved to Sussex to rebuild. It was during that time that we learned a pretty valuable life lesson. And as someone who has had to rebuild from nothing, a self-made individual, I have a lot of passion for the average Delawarean here. Currently, I have tallied that myself and my team have saved about $13 million across the healthcare industry. And I'd like to do that for all of Delaware. And that's why I'm running.
What does your professional experience, what piece of your professional experience make you the best candidate for state treasurer?
Well, I think that, across the healthcare industry, it's a very complex sort of sets of rules and regulations that we have to comply with. And to save dollars for patients is immensely rewarding. But also at the same time, I'm able to help small businesses to stay afloat and to stay long-term viable. I'm also able to keep certain service lines open that aren't necessarily currently profitable. And for me, that's been just amazingly life-giving. And I think that that's a big piece of what I want to do in the office and why I'm qualified. It's because when we're talking about finances, we're really talking about the people behind those numbers. And I think it's important that we're not forgetting why we are trying to steward these funds appropriately and to the best of our abilities.
In previous races, we've seen some candidates emphasize the state treasurer being a financial manager. Others have emphasized it being an economic watchdog. How do you view the treasurer's office and its role?
Well, again, I think that the primary role is truly to steward the funds appropriately and to invest them appropriately, low risk, highest return possible, and again, with that overall outlook. One of the pieces that we saw with Governor Markell that has really diminished over the last several years under the current administration is that opportunity for financial literacy programs. And again, you know, we have a really high number of retirees that are, you know, coming to our state. And I think it's really important that we are identifying that. There are a lot of people who are bringing with them skill sets and wisdom from their previous lives, and they're not done living. Mm-hmm. And one of the other things that I think is economically, not something to forget about is just the fact that for every hour that a volunteer works, it equates to $24. Mm-hmm. So we're talking $24 every hour. And if we have such a huge number of retirees who truly want to stay involved, again, that's a huge opportunity for our communities to build mentorships. And again, those financial literacy programs get kids into good paying jobs that they're actually skilled to perform. And again, I think to support our communities overall.
The current state treasurer has been a strong advocate for the process of what they call budget smoothing, a constitutional amendment that's would force lawmakers to limit spending in good years, save extra revenue for tight years. Lawmakers shelved that amendment last session. Governor Carney, though, did sign an executive order to move some portions of it forward. My question to you is, should lawmakers revisit that constitutional amendment and look at to eliminating the rainy day fund and creating a budget stabilization fund, which is the piece that was kind of shelved by not doing the amendment?
Right, right. I think that the important piece to that is first of all, it's always good to save, you know, to sort of get a sense of let's sort of set aside some funds in order to prepare for times when we may not have as much revenue. I think, again, the trouble with that is that it's not always a broad look at the revenue opportunities. And so I think that that has to be a piece of it. The other thing that ends up occurring when you do that is you also devalue the voter. Every vote determines who our legislators are, and our legislators, along with the governor, determine where we spend our money, what that budget looks like, you know, those types of things. And it's that congruent interaction that is very important. And I think what happened with this was people saw that there was potential to increase the role of the treasurer that may not necessarily have been is a bit of an overreach, I would say. Mm-hmm. When you're the one who's managing the money, you don't necessarily want to be the one who's also appropriating exactly where it goes. Mm-hmm. It's okay to maybe possibly be a voice on a board. But again, I think that sometimes it gets a little, you get into a gray zone, and I think that's where a lot of that concern stemmed from.
Are there some other issues, though, that you see that the treasurer can or should take a significant role in advocating for that would not be, as you just said, an overreach?
Yeah. So again, I think that going back to revitalizing some of those financial literacy programs that we saw and we are seeing diminished participation in. And again, I think that there's an opportunity to not only with the money school, but really take a step toward where everyone might be at different stages of their lives. Mm-hmm. You know, if I'm a kid who's preparing for college, how do I do that? Mm-hmm. Is it truly a good return on investment? If I'm, an older adult who's preparing for retirement, how do I do that? And maybe even, you know, the curveball, I'm a retiree who has planned for my retirement, and now I'm actually caring for my grandchildren. How do I shoulder that? Mm-hmm. And how do I financially do the best that I possibly can? And I think we do have an opportunity to help support people in that way and empower them rather than looking for opportunities to pinch and pull some of those benefits away. And really, that's what I would like to do.
And finally, I'm sure many people don't really completely understand the state treasurer's role in managing and investing the state's cash portfolio. So how would you explain it to the average voter and why it's important to them?
Well, I think it's extremely important to know exactly where our dollars are going. The money that flows in and out of the state is almost primarily tax dollars. And so when we're talking about your tax dollars, you really ought to be able to see exactly where it's being invested. And we've actually had 9 straight quarters where we have not seen how our money is being invested. And I can guarantee that will not happen under my administration. It's not fair to the taxpayer. They should know where their money is going.
Our thanks to Colleen Davis, Democratic candidate for state treasurer, for her time. Next on The Green, we hear from the Republican in this race, incumbent state treasurer Ken Simpler. But first, your local news from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Our series of candidate conversations in the state treasurer's race continues with the incumbent, Republican Ken Simpler. Simpler is seeking a second term as treasurer. He won the office in 2014, defeating Democrat Sean Barney and the Green Party's David Chandler to become the first non-incumbent Republican to win a statewide race since 1994. Here is our candidate conversation with Republican Ken Simpler. So we'll start off with the basic question of why you're running for another term as state treasurer.
I'm running for another term because I have seen firsthand after 4 years that while I went into this office with a high degree of confidence that someone who had spent their entire career in finance could improve on the core systems that we use to operate state government, whether it's our revenue systems or our budget systems or our personnel systems or our risk management systems, performance-based management systems, you know, I didn't know for sure. But after 4 years, I've had my chance to roll up my sleeves, work inside the treasurer's office, work with almost all of our other agencies in state government, and see real dividends from being able to take, let's say, a top-down look at how we're operating state government. And the fundamental systems we have, this is not an indictment of our people, the fundamental systems we have are 10, 20, or 40 years old. And if we can fix those systems, then every agency in state government, the things we actually see, education, roads, safety, healthcare, will improve. And so that's what I'm here for.
Tell me a little bit about how you feel like your previous professional experience helped inform what you've done in the first term and will help you kind of continue doing the things you think need to be done if you're elected to a second term.
So sure. So, I mean, there are jobs inside the treasurer's office. There are at least a dozen committees, councils, and boards I sit on. They're all financial in nature. And then there is the general job I have of being, frankly, the highest elected fiscal officer for the state, but collaborating with the Secretary of Finance and the Budget Director in what you would really think of as being the job of the Chief Financial Officer at Delaware. I have played the role of Chief Financial Officer and Asset Manager. And when you look at the Treasurer's operations day to day, the Treasurer really has a share of the whole fiscal picture for Delaware. Part of our business is asset management. We look after the $2 billion of debt. We look after the $2 billion cash portfolio. We look after probably $1.6 billion of third-party monies that are the monies that our teachers and our employees have saved in 401k style plans, $600 million that college savers have saved in our 529 plan. That's all based on asset management. And that's been a function of when I spent a career as a portfolio manager at a large private investment firm with global operations where I personally oversaw people in Tokyo, in London, in New York, Greenwich, Chicago, and San Francisco. These are the types of operations that I spent a career thinking about. How do you manage a balance sheet? How do you protect your, how do you think about in the state's portfolio ensuring that we have adequate access to our cash, that we get the best yield we can and keep it safe? How do we help participants who are saving for their own personal retirement plan, be retirement ready? And how do we manage the balance sheet from the perspective of, are we borrowing responsibly and investing for the next generation? That side of the house is what I've done for a career in finance as a portfolio manager. Mm-hmm. I've spent the other half of my finance career as a chief financial officer for a hotel and property management business here in Delaware. In that capacity, I have had to think about the exact same things across. There are multiple state agencies. All of them operate on the same basic platforms. If we can budget well for all of them, it's going to help everybody. If we can design personnel systems that allow us to attract and retain and develop people, that's going to benefit every state agency. If we have good ways of measuring performance management, are we executing good strategic planning? Are we allocating resources towards our priorities? And are we measuring whether we're getting better? That same experience was relevant in my prior career as a CFO because we had different operating units. We had different plants and facilities. Everyone wants to report their numbers in a different way. Everyone wants to budget differently. Everyone wants to... Some level of customization is appropriate. But if you're looking at an organization that's of the scale of the state of Delaware, 33,000 some employees, a $10 billion that we spend and take in every year. That's more than $10,000 for a man, woman, child in the state. At an organization of that level, we should have enterprise solutions that help us get better at everything we do. We shouldn't have agencies that succeed in spite of our systems. We should have agencies whose mission is facilitated by knowing that they have certain amounts of resources that are coming to them, being disciplined about how they plan strategically, having ways of measuring that let them know whether they're improving or not the core operations that they've set are their priorities. That kind of stuff, by and large, hasn't received attention in state government in a long time. We have a budgeting system that's 40 years old. We tried to fix it this last year with the General Assembly. They declined to take it up formally, but the governor issued an executive order, so we made some progress. Personnel systems across the board, I will tell you that people who manage in state government are handicapped in terms of developing their people the way they would like to because of well-meaning rules. But when personnel costs are half of the spend of our organization and we don't have the best means of incentivizing our people, of rewarding our people, of investing in our people and developing them, how are we going to get better at anything we do? So these are the kinds of things that don't fit on a bumper sticker. But if you're the state treasurer and the highest elected fiscal officer, these are the kinds of things you think about because you look for points of leverage in the organization. If all $10 billion of our spend flows through the state agencies and we can increase the productivity of state agencies by 1% or 2% or 3% because we invest in thoughtful budgeting and revenue and performance systems and risk management systems. That is enormous value to shareholders. It's enormous value to Delaware citizens. But you can see how I think about it with a corporate mindset.
Well, and kind of building on that, in previous races, we've seen some candidates emphasize this office as being an economic watchdog, others focusing more on the financial management part of it. How do you view the role of the treasurer and maybe the balance between those two trains of thought?
Yeah. So I think you can look at the treasurer, and the way I look at the job is really having three hats. I've spoken to you mostly about changes that I can make inside the treasurer's office, the day-to-day operations that permeate out and affect all state agencies. But I also sit on a dozen different councils, committees, and task forces. I am asked to engage as a member of task forces that preserve agricultural farmlands, which for Delaware's agriculture industry is critical. I sit on a committee that tries to help volunteer fire companies, of which we have roughly 60, think critically about capital spending, because they're a people business, but they're very capital intensive as well, that equipment and the buildings they have. I sit on the State Employee Benefits Committee, where the big focus is healthcare policy. So it's not as if I am administering the agencies that oversee that, agriculture or the Department of Human Resources or Office of Management and Budget. But I can bring the same principles to bear to say, hey, what are the key exercises? What are our goals? What are the resources we're willing to put behind those? How do we measure whether we're getting better? Is there another way of thinking about accomplishing our mission? You know, just to go back to one or two of the examples, since I know time is tight, but when I looked at what we can do with agricultural lands, our revenues go up and down every year because we tie it to the real estate transfer tax, which is a very volatile tax. Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, the real estate transfer tax generates the most money when land prices are the highest. So why would we want to structure the business model where we're trying to preserve land by paying the most for it? You know, wouldn't it be better if we had maybe a legacy trust where we put money in over time and we could take out interest or dividend income over time and buy when it was opportunistic to buy, keep the program running? You know, we're going to discuss things like that. You know, same thing for the firefighters. We have a revolving loan fund, but the amount we're able to save companies on their capital expenditures are because we let them borrow it at rates that are below market. But the amount we can save versus thinking about a different system, maybe what if we tried to think critically about how about if we compared our capital purchasing across all 60 companies and we opportunistically took advantage of the fact that we're going to go and everyone wants their own equipment. This mm-hmm. is not about not having autonomy at the local level. I don't want to get the firemen all freaked out that I'm saying we want, but a shared database, the power to purchase collectively. You know, there are other ways of thinking about how we accomplish our goals. Are we using the best means to get to where we want to be? That's something the state treasurer's office and the way I see my capacity is just helping other organizations, agencies, and boards think about their own planning and their own opportunity. And then there's the opportunity writ large as the state treasurer that, just like I'm sitting down with you here today, this is an enormous organization. It is self-governed. The people of Delaware, I can't explain anything in robust detail to them about almost anything. But can I give them some big picture ideas of how we're trying to think about the management of our state and our state government and how they can think about the way they can use information when they go into the ballot box in November? You know, I talk repeatedly with ordinary people up and down the state about what I think in finance are consensus issues. Does anyone in Delaware, regardless of your political affiliation, want to see the state run its affairs in a chaotic fashion or a more orderly fashion? Most people choose order. Do you want to know that your state government, regardless of how big or small you might think it is, some people want more government, some people want less. Does anyone dispute the idea that we should be accountable to you, that we're getting the best for what we do have? No. Again, a consensus issue. And frankly, given the period we've been through, most everyone that asks me, hey, Ken, how are we doing, really ultimately just wants to know that we're on a sustainable path. It's one thing to quarrel about whether it's too much or too little, but it's another thing to say that whatever path we've chosen, the bus is not going to end up off the road. We're going to keep all four wheels on the road. So just being able to convey to Delaware citizens how we're striving towards greater certainty and higher value and more sustainability in everything we do, that's another part of the way I think about my job.
Well, building on that, I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier, and that is during your first term, you've been a strong advocate for budget smoothing that would basically force the government to limit spending in good years, save the extra revenue for tight years. As you mentioned, lawmakers shelved the constitutional amendment to create a process to do that more formally last session, but Governor Carney signed an executive order to move portions of that forward. So my question to you is, should lawmakers revisit that constitutional amendment, look at establishing, or should say eliminating the rainy day fund and creating the budget stabilization fund? And you know, you can elaborate a little bit more on why that would be important.
Yeah, so I think the reason this really came about, and the reason that what we've come to call budget smoothing or budget stabilization, I would say there are two things that ordinary Delawareans should absolutely understand about what we're trying to do. Every year we balance the budget. That's what the Constitution requires to do it. But if we balance the budget and revenues are up, 10%, we spend 10% more. If we balance the budget and revenues are down 10%, we're supposed to spend 10% less. That is a very chaotic process, and it has real implications to real Delawareans. We cannot run the largest programs in the state in terms of safety and infrastructure and healthcare and education with following a test that says we're up and down 10% each year. And I don't make those numbers up because that's reality. The last 2 years, 2 years ago, we were down 10%. This last year, we were up 10%. That is no way to run a 33,000-person organization that spends $10 billion. Delawareans saw firsthand that when we don't run our affairs in a predictable and on a path that is smoother, nonprofits get their budgets cut. Realtors end up with taxes they didn't expect. State agencies are asked to cut budgets in ways they didn't anticipate that have real impact on our capacity to serve the public. There is no reason why we would have a test that says every year you spend exactly what you find in favor of a test that says let's pick a long-term path that is sustainable, and if the revenues come in higher, we'll save them, and if they come in lower, we'll be able to draw from that fund. So one point is just about stability and our ability to provide quality services and not leave critical services in the lurch or critical service providers or nonprofits in the lurch. The second big thing is year to year, it's bad enough. But what happens to us every 6 to 8 years? We have an economic recession. That's on average what economic recessions run. When we don't put away any money for a major downturn, we end up in real crises. And those real crises that, as we saw in the Great Recession, can be very severe, but in any case, they produce real hardships for real Delawareans. What is the excuse we have running this giant organization not to have a fund in place that, based on the calculations of looking at 40 years of data, and a little bit more than that actually, would allow us to sustain our spending through a recession and not raise taxes during a recession? The way we approach these cycles now is that's what we do both. So in the height of a recession, when business is suffering, when real people in Delaware need critical services, what does the state of Delaware do to balance its budget? We cut services and we raise taxes, both of which have been demonstrated in studies to both prolong recessions and make them deeper. You want the state in those situations to be acting as a counterbalance to the economy. You want the state to be able to remain the stable partner to allow business to get back on its feet and to allow people that have higher service demands to have their needs met. That's what a stabilization fund would allow us to do. So it's the annual inability to plan and be consistent in what we deliver. And it's the once periodically that we know we're going to experience deep recession that we should be more responsible about having a long-term view around.
Having said all that, are there some other issues you feel the treasurer can or should take a significant role in advocating for? I know you've talked about some of them a little bit earlier, but are there some ones that in your mind you feel a treasurer should be focused on advocating for?
Yeah, so in the first 4 years, we took two major priorities in the office. One was we rebuilt the retirement platform for state teachers and state employees, and we reset the strategic framework for the college plans. Those were both multi-year efforts that have resulted in lower fees, better product offerings, and frankly, more participation in the plans. So we're helping people, individuals, save more of their own money in those situations, whether for retirement or for college. I think it's very important that we empower people to affect their own savings. And ultimately, that has implications for us as taxpayers because, if people can take care of themselves responsibly, it means less burden on us as other citizens. The same thing was true. We took 2.5 years to reset the guidelines and the platforms that we use to invest the state's money. So the Cash Management Policy Board had been in a terrible position with my predecessor. They didn't see eye to eye. It took a long time to rectify that, but we just put in place over 2.5 years a new set of guidelines, a new set of investment managers. The consultant for the board, not my consultant, estimates that this will likely produce as much as $20 million more per annum for the state's investment portfolio in a normalized environment. We've already seen it in just the DFAC numbers we just published. If you look back at what we've done the last several years, what we earned just in this last year is almost 2.5 times what we have, you know, done in the last couple. And even since the Great Recession, it's almost double the average, and it's going to go up this coming year. The two major initiatives I could see that would parallel those reforms in another 4 years are one, just like we talked about the idea of how we get our revenues and our expenditures to sort of be sustainable over the long term. You know, we're talking about our operating budget. There is a similar way we could think about our capital budget. Mm-hmm. Our capital budget goes through the same cycle of up and down. We're allowed to borrow the same percentage of revenues every year, 5%. So as revenues go up and down, the amount we borrow to do capital projects goes up and down. But we also usually, in good years, are able to commit more cash. Actually, part of our operating budget is used to fund capital projects. Mm-hmm. When the operating budget goes bad, the cash to the bonds or cash to the capital budget goes to zero. Mm-hmm. We saw that. We saw zero to the cash. And so there is another, I think, effectively new construct that we could put in place that tells us what's a sustainable long-term level of borrowing and how do we get to a world where instead of having our capital projects swing up and down every year, how are we disciplined over the long term? We do not want to use deficits in the operating budget to underinvest for the next generation. That is not good to, that's not the right thing to do for our kids, and it's not the right thing to do for future Delawareans, but that's what we do today. We make up shortfalls in the operating budget by underinvesting in the long term. So I think there is something to be said for both working on the operating budget and then in parallel working on the capital budget. And so I would love to dig into that as part of my second term. And then the other big thing is we have spent almost a year studying the entirety of the state in terms of its ability to just simply transact business. So one role the treasurer plays that the treasurer is responsible for is everything we do in state government, we collect and receive money. All agencies, across all departments, everything. The state treasurer's office in 25 years has never undertaken a comprehensive study of all the banking and transaction services we've been allowed that have accumulated over that time period. More than a dozen different vendors, different agencies using different vendors, different agencies, you know, having different personnel in terms of their level of understanding of what is possible to make their own operations run more smoothly. We think state agencies can save a ton of manpower if we are able to take an enterprise sort of approach to this. If we are able to face our agencies as a partner and say, here's the range of things that modern financial services would allow you to do. Here's what you're doing today. This is what could be freed up in terms of your personnel time, whether it's automation, whether it's the third party doing it for you. We think we can save significant out-of-pocket costs by consolidating and updating the entire architecture of how state of Delaware just simply transacts business. That is going to be every bit of all 4 years of a second term. Those would be the big ideas.
And finally, and we've talked a little bit about this already, but I'm sure many people don't completely understand the state treasurer's role in managing and investing the state's cash portfolio. So how would you explain it to the average voter and why it's important to them?
I think the way people think about this in their personal lives that they understand is my job is not to decide how much we spend or how much we take in. That's the General Assembly and the governor. Within any level of spending and taxation, my job is to ensure that we stretch every dollar as far as we can possibly stretch it, that we get the maximum value out of whatever it is we decide to levy on our people and we return a high level of services for it. I think it's also my job to ensure that we think about the rainy day, that we plan ahead, that we don't, the whole organization of state government, the General Assembly and the governor are caught up all the time in a one-year-to-one-year process. Who is looking out over the horizon? Who is thinking about not just this budget year, but how we put in place the practices, the rules, the laws They're going to ensure that we meet long-term needs, not just today's needs. So stretch every dollar, make sure we're investing for the future, and ultimately guarantee people that whether you like it or not, whatever it is we're doing, we're going to do an excellent job of it. We're going to be able to show you in an accountable way that we are making the most of our collective resources. That's how I would explain to just, you know, the layperson who's thinking of this, just without getting into the weeds of what the treasurer does.
Our thanks to Ken Simpler, Republican candidate for state treasurer, for his time this week. We'll hear from the Green Party's candidate in this race, David Chandler, next week. Next up on this week's edition of The Green, our latest arts playlist. Stay with us. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. An electric chamber ensemble from New York City will perform at the Delaware Art Museum in Wilmington next month. The Bang on a Can All-Stars perform Thursday, October 11th, continuing their 30th anniversary tour that began in 2017. The Bang on a Can All-Stars are known for their mix of classical, jazz, rock, world, and experimental genres, and their dynamic live performances. The Bang on a Can All-Stars performance at the Delaware Art Museum will feature works written for the ensemble by several of the group's co-founding composers, including David Lang, who's also scheduled to perform. For our latest arts playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele recently spoke with Lang about the performance, the music, and how this ensemble got its name.
All right, New York's Electric Chamber Ensemble, the Bang on a Can All-Stars, is going to be performing a high-octane concert at the Delaware Art Museum. It's coming up on Thursday, October 11th. And to break it all down and tell me all about it is David Lang. He's one of the co-founding composers. David, thanks for joining me.
Hey there.
Talk to me about Bang on a Can All-Stars.
Well, Bang on a Can All-Stars is an ensemble that grew out of a larger organization called Bang on a Can, a festival in New York. And it was started by two other composers and me in 1987. So Michael Gordon and Julia Wolf and I, we were young composers living in New York, you know, doing the things that young composers do, which is basically you sit around all day and you complain about your life, about how your music isn't getting played, the music that's interesting to you isn't getting played, the institutions that exist don't represent you, things that could be happening that would be really exciting in the music world aren't happening, at least the way we thought they should be happening. And so after a year of sitting around and just, you know, thinking about all the ways the music world could be different, we just looked at each other and thought, you know, no one's going to change this world unless we do it. So we started this organization, Bang on a Can, and the idea was to find all the people in all the different musical forms, so in classical music, in pop music, in folk music, all the people who are trying to be innovative, all the people who are trying to push the boundary, all the people who are trying to cross between genres. We thought, you know, maybe we could make a place where all of those kinds of musics could meet. I don't know if your listenership remembers record stores.
You know? I remember record stores. I'm that old, so I do. I don't know about our listeners.
I love record stores, and I learned everything I know about music from record stores. And when you would go into a record store, there would be a room that said classical music and a room that said jazz and
yep.
a room that said world music. And they'd all be separated with, you know, soundproof walls so that you wouldn't have any bleed from one to the other. But actually what happens with composers and musicians is they imagine all the ways that their music can cross through those walls. There are a lot of composers who don't wake up and say, how do I fit squarely in a category? How do I live only in one of those locations? You know, there are a lot of people who wake up and they go, you know, here's a boundary between my little niche and some other niche, and no one's crossed it before. What would happen if I crossed it? And the weird thing about the music world, especially in the late 80s, was that for people who were interested in crossing those boundaries, there wasn't a good place for them to go. And we thought that Bang on a Can would be a place where all of those kind of boundary crossing composers would find a home.
Why that name?
Well, it's interesting. You know, when you think about music, sometimes in classical music, you know, we all went to school. We love classical music. You know, I am as nerdy as they come. I have a doctorate in classical music, and I teach at Yale. And, you know, we are nerds, right? You study classical music by loving and revering and worshiping all this amazingly great music from hundreds of years ago, which is completely worthy of our love and respect. Sometimes with music that comes from the classical world, it can make people feel unwelcome if they don't have all of that erudition and all of that background. You know, I think that's, you know, like a real problem, that classical music has so much information attached to it that it puts people off. So we thought we needed a title that would make it seem like music was elemental and primal and fun, and make it seem like if you didn't have all of those years of background, you were still welcome and you would still get something out of it. And so, you know, if you imagine calling it the New York Festival of Really Serious Music, or if you call it, something with a normal title.
Anything but what it's called.
Yeah, anything but what it's called. So we were sitting around trying to describe what we do, right? And Julie said, how about just some composers sit around and bang on a can? And then we laughed about it like crazy. We just thought that was so funny.
That's great.
And we just decided that would be our name.
All right. So performing throughout the United States and internationally as well, the Bang on a Can All-Stars have really shattered, as you've already painted a picture-perfect scenario for us already. You've really shattered the definition of what concert music is today. So for those of us attending the event at the Delaware Art Museum, what can we expect?
Well, the All-Stars have been around for about over 25 years, and they're, you know, all these incredibly great players. So individually, they're unbelievably virtuosic and powerful and dramatic and incredible. We put them together in an ensemble, and we built the ensemble so that it would be kind of like a hybrid that would go between all these different worlds. So there are musicians in this band who have backgrounds in jazz, who have backgrounds in contemporary music. Our guitarist is the music director for Paul Simon. So there are people who have this incredible array of abilities and backgrounds. And that's the kind of music that we want to play, music that that is hard to pin down about where it comes from.
Where is everybody from?
From all over. But, you know, our pianist is from Canada. Our bassist is from Connecticut. You know, a lot of people in New York. You know, we're sort of New York-centric a little bit. But the thing that's interesting about this is that if you look at the band, it doesn't really look like any other band you've ever seen, because it has musicians, it has instruments from the classical world. So it has a cello, it has a bass, instruments from rock and roll, has electric guitar, has a drum set. You know, all of the music that we play is amplified. So one of the things that you're going to hear on this concert, you're going to hear all of this really intricate and beautiful and delicate chamber music, the same way that a classical ensemble plays this really kind of delicate chamber music, but it's amplified. So it has this kind of energy and power and kind of forcefulness of pop music.
All right. Does Bang on a Can have a website?
Yes, we do. It's bangonacan.org. There's a huge amount of information there because, as you would imagine, in 32 years of business, we've accumulated a lot of stuff.
Thanks to the Bang on a Can All-Stars, David Lang, and our Kelly Steele for this week's Arts Playlist. You can learn more about the October 11th Bang on a Can All-Stars performance at the Delaware Art Museum, including how to get tickets at DelawarePublic.org. And that's all for this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor Larry Nagengast, and Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele.
for them and all the staff here at Delaware Public Media. I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.